Hello again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 3rd of November, the day before the presidential election. And we're delighted to have Robert Dahlak with us this hour, prominent American historian who has written so many books about American presidents. His most recent is Truman, which was just published. And we have yet to talk to him about Truman. We'll do that. We'll spend a little bit of this hour talking about Truman, but we need to devote a full hour to his book. He's the author of Nixon and Kissinger, Partners in Power, Lessons from the Lives and Times of Presidents, Lyndon B. Johnson, Portrait of a President, An Unfinished Life, John F. Kennedy from 1917 to 1963, several actually books on Johnson, another flawed giant, Lyndon Johnson and his times, and Lone Star Rising, Franklin D. Roosevelt as a world leader. The list goes on and on. He has taught at a number of places, UCLA, Oxford, Columbia, and at Boston University and the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas. He's with us this hour to place this election of 2008 in a historical context and welcome your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Or if you'd like to send an email, you can do that, and that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Robert Dahlak, what a pleasure to have you on today of all days. Thank you so much for being with us.
Sure, my pleasure to be with you.
We spent some time. I loved your book on John F. Kennedy. Well, I like all your books, but I loved An Unfinished Life, and I was rereading some of it last night. And you talk about, and it's now many years since the election of 1960, it's difficult to imagine the importance of something that no longer seems significant in discussions about suitability for the White House. Whatever gains and losses John Kennedy's presidency might have brought to the country and the world, his election in 1960 marked a great leap forward in religious tolerance that has served the nation well ever since. Is that the comparison we make now with Barack Obama, do you think, in 2008, that it's a racial tolerance that we might be seeing more of should he win tomorrow? What does it do for race relations, and how do you compare it to 1960?
Yeah, I think it's an apt analogy, because this is in a sense, a game-changing election. Barack Obama becomes president, forever thereafter, we will no longer take umbrage or exception to the idea that an African American could become president, and I think also that in the future the assumption will be that women can run for the presidency. It just changes the whole perspective. And you know, when you look back on 1960 now, would anybody at this point raise a question about somebody who was running who was Catholic? It's just irrelevant. Nobody would raise any questions about that. And so I think that's the way it'll be in the future. Obama wins the presidency, and it'll be true for African Americans, for women, for an Asian American in the future. I think it just opens the door to anybody. And the wonderful part about it is it will greatly increase the pool of talent that we can turn to for future candidates. And heavens knows, we need all the talent we can get.
There's also, I think, something, and I'm trying to put my finger on what exactly it is, the enthusiasm and excitement that has been generated in this election by his candidacy, particularly, I think, that is similar to the kind of excitement, or maybe it's because I came from an Irish Catholic family, and oh man, were they excited about John F. Kennedy. It was a sight to behold. You couldn't help but take some of that in when you were a kid. Is there something similar in that regard too, that quality that makes, you know, people cry at a nominating process, that makes people cry because here's somebody who's outmaneuvered everybody else and has had to work very hard to get where he is?
Yeah, because, you know, there's been some attacks on Obama as an elitist, and of course he has an elite education, a bachelor's degree from Columbia University, law degree from Harvard, and president of the Harvard Law Review. But, you know, he's very much an up-from-the-bootstraps sort of guy. And what makes it, I think, so exciting for people is the feeling that America is still a young society. It's fresh. It's open. Possibilities remain so much a part of our national perspective. And I think people love that. Indeed, what I keep saying is, when you ask people in this country who the greatest presidents in American history were, they predictably tell you George Washington, Abraham Lincoln, Franklin Roosevelt, but then they add the names of John Kennedy and Ronald Reagan. And I think that's because people want optimism, they want hope, and they remember Kennedy and Reagan as being so hopeful and optimistic. Kennedy, the new frontier, promising put a man on the moon by the end of the decade. Reagan, the pride is back, morning in America. And Obama brings that. See, that's what I think projected him to the forefront and gave him the leg up in this campaign. Hope, you know, people began decrying this this word and saying, "Oh, you know, it's superficial." And but it's really what I think generated so much appeal for him and brought him to the center of his. Of this political campaign. So he caught the wave. He understood what the public mood was. Also, I would say that this election is, I think, in many ways a referendum on the Bush presidency and the rejection of it now. And also, I think one might end up seeing this election as the end of the conservative period in our history. You know, Arthur Schlesinger used to write about the cycles of American political history, and I think there is a fundamental truth to this, and we've been through this 30-year cycle now of conservatism, if we go back to roughly 1980 and Ronald Reagan, and I think we will see, if Obama wins, a new period of progressive federal activism. It won't last forever, but it will be a surge going back to a kind of experience we've had before.
And tell me what form that progressive federal activism would take.
Well, I think that there will be a lot of analogies to the New Deal because we're in this period now of economic anxiety, a sense that the economic future of this country is very uncertain. And I think the touchstone will be what did Roosevelt do? What did the New Deal do? And it's not going to be, you know, a replication. You can't do that. You're not going to go back and just pick up on FDR's programs and reinvent them. But there will be, we will see these programs as a starting point, a place to think about how we're going to respond to the country's economic current economic dilemma, and it will make for, I think it's going to draw a lot of young people to Washington, and memories of Roosevelt, memories of John Kennedy, the Peace Corps, Teach for America. I think there'll be a sense of renewed idealism and hope and eagerness to participate in. You know, when the Great Depression came along and the New Deal occurred, Joe Kennedy, John Kennedy's father, said to his sons, Joe Jr., John, Robert Kennedy, he told them that the next generation of big people in this country are going to be in government, not in business. See, it had been people who were in business, but he said that'll no longer be the case. It's going to be people in government. And I think he was absolutely right. And I think we're going to get back to some of that now. I think we're seeing a similar turning of the wheel.
We're talking as though it's already Wednesday and Obama won. Do you think there's, do you think there's any doubt he's going to win, Robert Dulick?
Oh, boy, am I going to have egg on my face if I'm wrong. But, you know, I think if Obama loses now, the pollsters my goodness, are they going to be discredited?
They sure will be.
Because, and like, you know, what is how far is Obama ahead in Wisconsin? 10 points?
Right. It was seven. What is it now, Rhonda? I'm not sure where it is. I think it's 10 now. It was 7 a few days ago. It had gone down a bit, but I'm waiting until noon today to check everything. So
okay. I don't
my obsession will continue. You talked about an end of conservative in American history. I know that over the weekend you wrote about Sarah Palin in U.S. News and World Report. What about Sarah Palin, though? Isn't she an indication that there is a very, very healthy, very conservative movement still alive and well in the United States?
Well, it certainly is alive, and how well it is and how healthy it is another matter. I think what will be very difficult for her specifically, she's become the object of ridicule. And I don't know if you followed this thing recently about her and the spoof that some people called her from Canada and pretended to
right.
be, you know, the French
Sarkozy,
president. I mean, she's become the object of ridicule, and it's very difficult, I think, in politics to forge ahead when people are poking fun at you all the time. Now, she is a representative of that conservative faith, of that impulse, but I think they'll be in a minority and on the defensive in the immediate future. I don't think that they are going to dominate American politics. They have in the recent years. So I'm not suggesting that, you know, they're going away or that they've become irrelevant. They remain a force and an influence, but I think that they'll be in the background in a sense, and they'll forge ahead again. They'll come back to the front and center at some point, but I think for the time being, they won't dominate the political scene.
Mm-hmm. Rhonda checked on the lead. Obama has an 11-point lead in Wisconsin. That's where we are right now.
Yep.
Let's talk a little bit about Harry Truman, and we have to have you on talking about your book, which you know I haven't read yet. I have to get it. We have to do
an
interview.
Short book.
Well,
it's part of the series that Arthur Schlesinger was editing short presidential biographies, and it's about 180 pages total.
Good. All right. Well, we'll have you on about it. But you talk. I was mentioning that U.S. News and World Report piece that you wrote, which was in Saturday, I believe. What about this embrace of Truman particularly by Sarah Palin, who, as you write, compared herself to him at her acceptance speech, and the rush to embrace Truman, which you say tells us more about contemporary politics than about the realities of his career.
Yeah, I think it does. Well, you know, Harry Truman was in very bad odor at the end of his presidency. In the last year or so of his term, he went down to 22% approval. When he left office, he was at 32% approval. But 22% is the lowest any president has reached in one of those polls, and George W. Bush has matched it, according to recent polling data I've seen. So he was in very bad standing. But what's happened is that since, he's made a terrific comeback, and he's currently seen as a near-great American president and one of the greatest of the 20th century. And I think that has a lot to do with two or three things. One is that people now find his personality very engaging, and David McCulloch's very big, successful book on Harry Truman several years ago contributed substantially to that. But in addition to people finding him so appealing because he was straightforward, you know, and after Kennedy's assassination, Johnson and the Vietnam War, Nixon and Watergate, and Nixon having to stand up to the press and say, "I'm not a crook," and Bill Clinton, "I did not have sex with that woman." And so Harry Truman comes across to people, I think, now as a very appealing straight shooter. But more importantly is the fact that he's seen as the architect of the winning strategy in the Cold War. He's the one who put into place containment, And at the end of his term, actually, on January 15th, 1953, 5 days before he left office, he said, "I cannot tell you when, and I can't tell you exactly how it will come about, but in time, Soviet communism will collapse. It will fall of its own weight." And he had it absolutely right. And we didn't have to go to war with the Soviet Union. What we need to do is contain them. And so he gets a lot of credit for that. And also, I think he gets credit at this point for having spurred forward the modern civil rights movement. He was the one who set up this commission to secure these rights and integrated the American military. It was a substantial step forward. So we look back on his presidency now as very appealing. And it's so interesting that the Republicans try to appropriate his reputation, so to speak. Palin speaks of herself as a small-town person, the way Harry Truman was, and John McCain went to Independence, Missouri, to the Truman Library not that long ago. I think it was October 1 or something like that. And George W. Bush keeps saying that he'll be remembered the way Harry Truman is now remembered. Well, that's his hope, but I doubt that he's a Harry Truman, but we'll see what happens in 30 or 40 years.
You also wrote in that piece about how he was self-educated. He was the only 20th century president without a college degree, but better educated than most of his predecessors or successors, and you can't really say that about Sarah Palin.
No, you can't. She doesn't, at least so far. You know, it's hard to know what to make of her exactly, but and of course, if she loses tomorrow, she may just fade into the woodwork, so to speak. She will be remembered as the first woman to have been on the Republican ticket as a vice presidential candidate, but beyond that, hard to imagine what her standing is going to be or what record she sort of had. So, I mean, she will, you know, vice presidents don't, or candidates for the vice presidency don't resonate a great deal in our history. Remember what Woodrow Wilson said about the vice presidency? Of course, it's changed a great deal now, but in Wilson's day, he said, "There's nothing to say about the vice presidency, and after you've said that, there's nothing more to say." So, but it's changed now, but still, you know, vice presidents are not the most memorable figures on our historical memory.
Prominent historian, and particularly presidential historian, Robert Dalek is our guest this hour, and we're welcoming phone calls for him, which will go to pretty much, not immediately, but momentarily. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it is the same number. And if you'd like to send an email, you can do that at talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls now for Professor Robert Dalek, and we're going to start with Carl from Milwaukee. Hello, Carl.
Hello.
Hi.
I would like to ask, that given this archaic anachronism we have of the Electoral College system, which to my knowledge is not shared with any other major democracy in the world, what are the chances that that could be changed? And if it would be, would it require merely an act of Congress, or would it be a constitutional amendment procedure that would be required? And what are the possibilities in general that this could maybe finally occur, given how many, a number of presidents have been elected, but who have not won the popular vote?
Well, my sense is that this is a very, very difficult hurdle to surmount. You know, we've had this Electoral College from the start of our history, and there has been, of course, in the past, system, to get rid of it, to have a popular vote, which does make a great deal of sense, but there is tremendous resistance to it, and I really have great doubts that we will be seeing a change of this kind anytime in the near future. And in part, I think, in significant part, I think that's because whoever becomes president after tomorrow is going to have such a full agenda. There's so much to be done that's going to require so much energy and commitment from the Congress, from the public, to deal with the economy, to deal with the environment, to deal with issues of the issue of health insurance for all those people who are uninsured or underinsured. So there's so much on the table that needs to be addressed that I think for the time being it would be very difficult to get the country to focus on the issue of the Electoral College. Now, if there were something that happened in this election that really put it front and center and created some huge frustration for a majority of voters, then maybe there'd be an impulse in that direction. But I would not bank on it. And, I just don't see anything happening with this for the foreseeable future.
Thanks very much for the call. The only thing that seems to be problematic and is troublesome to me, Robert Dalek, are these long lines. This early voting is a good idea, but you've got to have enough places open so people can vote.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, there's been suggestions, and I find this quite appealing, that there should be polls opened on the weekend, that what you should do is run this over several days.
Sure.
And not just do it on Tuesday. I mean, now there is more and more of this early voting, but it speaks volumes about the current enthusiasm that you've gotten such a big turnout in places like Colorado, for example, and Florida. People are flocking to the polls. You know, in recent history, the turnout for these presidential elections have been somewhere in the low 50s, and I wouldn't be surprised if we break 60% of that is of those eligible to vote in this current election, which will be really a step up for democracy. You know, in some countries like Australia, voting is mandatory. You can be fined if you don't vote. Now, we don't do that, of course, and I don't know that we'd want to, but I think it's encouraging that people have gotten so interested in this current election that that they're turning out in such large numbers.
Reed is next from Clintonville. Hi, Reed.
Good morning. Say, as an early voter here and a person that is concerned about our country, I would just question the guest as to whether or not he thinks cooler heads might prevail if the Republicans do have a conference of some sort after the election to discuss the direction of the party and the representatives of the party that are really in the forefront. And I might make a comment concerning Ms. Palin. We must remember that her speeches are written for her. I would hope that she would not have the chutzpah to compare herself to Harry Truman. Though Harry Truman was not a college-educated individual, he was an extremely bright man. Mm-hmm. Ms. Palin had to go to four, I believe, maybe five colleges to get a bachelor's degree.
Six.
Hmm. So those are my comments, and I'll listen off the air.
Thanks, Reed. Thanks for the call.
Yeah, well, I think there will be a lot of soul-searching if the Republicans take as substantial a drubbing as predicted by the pundits, which means not only became losing the presidency by a substantial margin, but the Republicans losing 25 or 30 additional seats in the House and seven or eight other seats in the additional seats in the Senate. It might bring the Democrats up to 58, 59, and maybe even 60. So I think there will be an awful lot of soul searching, and who knows? I would imagine that some cooler heads may prevail, and there may be a lot of feeling that if the party is going to recoup and regain standing, political standing in the country, they're going to want to move more to the center. But, you know, I think there will also be the impulse to say, well, let's give our opponents enough rope to hang themselves, and let's wait and see what happens. The Democrats will have so much power, so much control, and that if they don't turn the economy in a more prosperous direction, there's going to be a lot of recrimination. And so I think there will be some of that impulse to wait and see what the Democrats do do their worst. As far as Palin goes, the gentleman, I think, is quite right. You know, she went to apparently six different institutions of higher learning in order to finally get a bachelor's degree. And but, you know, it's not that she went to so many institutions or wherever she went. It's just that in these interviews, she's appeared to be so lacking in fundamental information, knowledge about the American governmental system and even the role of the vice presidency. So I think that's what puts her on the defensive and has opened her to so much criticism.
And thanks very much for your call. Let's go next to Daniel from, oops, I got the wrong button here, Daniel from Rice Lake. Hi, Daniel.
Hello. There is a bizarre, to me, call from the religious right for prayers for McCain's election, and also a call for fasting today. In 60, were there calls from the Catholic priests from the pulpit for similar prayers for divine intervention on behalf of JFK?
As far as I know, there were not. And I think that was partly out of an understanding that if the Catholic Church in America became openly an open advocate of Kennedy's election and promoting the idea that the election could be decided by prayer of his co-religionists, it might work against him and might agitate the feeling that, well, Catholics are trying so hard to get one of their own into the White House so that they can benefit their church. And because, you know, the knock on Kennedy was that he's a Catholic and it's going to give the Pope in Rome so much influence. Harry Truman had a very good line during that election. He said, it's not the Pope I'm so worried about, it's the Pop, meaning Joseph Kennedy, who was John's father, and Harry Truman didn't like him one bit because he had been Roosevelt's ambassador to Great Britain and had been supportive of Chamberlain and appeasement and hardly as critical of the Nazis as most Americans were.
Mm-hmm.
So, no, I don't think that there was anything of that sort by the Catholic hierarchy during the 1960 election. Mm.
What was the outcome of that election? Was it several hundred thousand votes, which still is hard to believe? It was so close.
Yeah, for the Kennedy election.
Right.
Yeah, he won by 118,000.
Was it that? Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, that's all. 118,000 is what separated them.
Huh.
It was very close.
Yeah. My son was saying to me on the way to school today, he said, because I've been a little bit obsessed with this, I tend to do this for all the elections, you know.
Haven't we all?
I know, I'm watching too much TV, et cetera. But he said, imagine being the guy and gal, which is true, who's going to wake up on Wednesday if they go to sleep, and they've lost, and they've spent all these years running for president. It is true. What a feeling that must be.
You're so right. You're so absolutely right. I have a friend in Missouri, who a woman who is an attorney, who ran for United States Senate seat in 1994, ran in the primary, in the Democratic primary. She lost. You know, I think it took her 6 months to get over this.
Hmm.
It was just, she had thrown herself so much into this, and she, you know, spent some of her own money on it, but I don't think it was the money, it was the emotional commitment. And if that's the case for a primary contest for a Senate seat, you can imagine what it must feel like to lose one of these presidential elections, which, you know, you've been battling for 2 years.
Right.
One can only feel a certain sympathy from afar, I guess, for whoever loses one of those campaigns. Adlai Stevenson lost twice, of course, and he became very philosophical about it. And I guess you have to be, but it's not easy. And especially in light of how acrimonious and harsh these campaigns are, and the nastiness. Look at this campaign in North Carolina for the Senate seat. Just so became so ugly, that ad that Elizabeth Dole put out, seems to me at least, it was so over the line.
Right.
But, you know, when Thomas Jefferson ran in 1800 against John Adams, they accused Jefferson of being the Antichrist, and the blood will roll in the streets, will pour out in the streets, like in the French Revolution, if he wins. And he responded when he won by, in his great inaugural speech, in which he said, "We are all Federalists, we are all Republicans."
Right.
Because that was the first presidential election in the country's history when you had a transfer of power from one party to another. And it made for this idea that we have a constitutional opposition, and we don't have to have violence when we move from one political faction to another.
Mm-hmm. Let's thanks so much, Daniel, for your call. Let's go next to Jeff from Madison. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. I think if I woke up the morning after the election and had lost this, in this world, I'd breathe a sigh of relief, frankly.
That's very good point.
I just found a table online, which I won't go through in detail, but just the impact of it, I think, is very important in putting to bed these allegations of Obama as socialist. And it's just very interesting. In 1922 through 33, when Harding, Coolidge, and Hoover were presidents, all Republicans, the top marginal income tax rate went from 56, it went down under Coolidge to 24 just at the time we went into Great Depression, went into the 20s, and then Hoover brought it back up into the 60s, which I found interesting. In Eisenhower's time, it was 91% his entire time in office. Under Nixon, it was 70%. Reagan started with 70, and it was 50% most of his time. He did bring it down to near I call it Great Depression levels, back to 28%. And Obama is now seeking to bring it back to the 39.6, which was under Clinton, which was roughly the same under, it was a little bit higher than Bush 1, and just 3, 4% under Bush 2. So, I mean, to call this socialist because he's raising top marginal rates, it just flies in the face of our history, especially in the history of Republican administrations in the past century. Anyway, I'll listen to your comment.
Thanks, Jeff.
Well, I think that's an excellent piece of analysis, and just so accurate. And also we have this history that apparently the stock market does much better during the Democratic administrations than Republican administrations, which seems to be a contradiction. You would think that it would be the other way around. But, the gentleman's quite right that under Eisenhower and when Kennedy came to office, one of his big initiatives was to cut the tax rate from 91%. Down to the 70%, which in fact came about when Lyndon Johnson got that passed in 1964 after Kennedy had been killed. These tax rates have been very high under some Republican administrations. And also in this business of socialism, you know, my guess is that so many young people in this country who are coming out to vote for the first time, they're probably mystified by this charge about socialism and redistributing wealth, and it just probably seems so remote and unimportant and irrelevant to them. You know, this is not the days of the Cold War and waving the flag of, you know, about the Red Menace and the Red Scare and the socialism. Just it seems archaic almost. Just something that, and it's apparently not resonating. I mean, people have, to the good sense of the voters, they just don't seem to be paying much attention to this, seeing it as irrelevant.
Thanks so much for the call, Jeff. How will you spend tomorrow, Robert?
Pardon?
How are you going to spend tomorrow?
Well, I will vote. I live in the District of Columbia. And even though voting here is without significant consequence, because in the District of Columbia last time, John Kerry got 91% of the
vote
to Bush's 9%. And this time, I suspect Obama will get about 94-95% of the vote. So, but I nevertheless, I always have find it thrilling to vote. And in the evening, we will be going to a friend's home who actually is a former congressman, and he has people over on election night, and there will be he's a former Democratic congressman, but there will be some Republicans there, including Kenneth Edelman, who's a friend of his. And Edelman, you know, was Reagan's arms control negotiator, and a very conservative man. And Edelman has come out, and there was a published story in the Washington Post.
Sure.
He's come out for Obama. And he said he found the choice of Palin just unacceptable, the way Colin Powell did. So it should be an interesting evening.
Yes, it will be. Isn't it great to vote? I'm with you. I love to go vote.
Oh, I do too. I enjoy it. It's just great fun.
It is, and it remains so. Let's pause for a moment and we'll return. Robert Dahlak is our guest this hour, prominent American historian who specializes in American presidents and has written so many. He just hasn't written a book that's not worth reading. He's a wonderful writer. Nixon and Kissinger, Partners in Power. He's just written a short book on Truman, and we'll schedule him for a program as we look exclusively at Truman down the road. Lessons from the Lives and Times of Presidents. He's written several books on Lyndon Johnson, Portrait of a President, Lone Star Rising, Lyndon Johnson and the Times, and Flawed Giant, Lyndon Johnson and His Times. One is 61 to 73, and one is 1908 to 1960. He's written about Franklin Roosevelt, several books on him, a wonderful book on John F. Kennedy, An Unfinished Life, 1917 to 1963, and we're happy to have him with us. He has taught at a number of places, at Columbia, UCLA, Oxford, Boston University, and we're going to take more phone calls for him. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Professor Robert Dahlak is our guest. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. And we go next to Alan from Tomahawk. Hi, Alan.
Good morning, Kathleen. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Long-time listener, first-time caller, so I'm a bit nervous.
Oh, don't be nervous. It's just the two of us, the three of us.
The Republicans have made an issue over Barack Obama's lack of executive experience, but I would like to draw a parallel between his experience and that of Abraham Lincoln's. Lincoln spent 8 years in the Illinois State House of Representatives for 2-year terms. Obama, 8 years in the Illinois State Senate for 2 4-year terms. Abraham Lincoln was 2 years in the U.S. House of Representatives, and Barack Obama 2 years in the U.S. Senate, although I suppose maybe only two of those count since he's really been campaigning for about 2 years. But to continue, Lincoln gained national prominence in his debates with Stephen Douglas when he ran for the Senate, and Barack Obama gained national prominence with his keynote speech during the 2004 Democratic National Convention, in his run for the Senate. And it just seems to me illogical that people would be picking on Obama for his lack of experience. I seem to think that you and I probably bear some passion for Lincoln, and I think we can agree that he did a pretty good job with his lack of experience, don't you?
I would certainly say so. In fact, several months back, I published an op-ed article saying that judgment is more important than experience because, you know, when you look at the issue of experience, for example, Herbert Hoover, who was a very intelligent man and highly experienced, served for 8 years as Secretary of Commerce throughout all those Republican administrations and the two previous administrations to his in the 1920s, you could hardly find someone more experienced in terms of the national economy than Hoover, and yet he failed miserably. One can think about Dick Cheney and Donald Rumsfeld as highly experienced national security officials, and look what they gave us in terms of the Iraq War, in which we've had so much suffering and grief. So I don't think experience is quite what it's cracked up to be. I really prefer to think in terms of judgment and Lincoln's judgment. And John Kennedy first came into office and made the mistake of poor judgment of getting involved in the Bay of Pigs operation. And then he saw the error of his ways. And during the Cuban Missile Crisis, I think both his earlier experience and his revised judgment led him to be very successful in that terrible Cold War crisis we confronted. So I think judgment, and this is what I think a lot of people are seeing about Barack Obama, that he's someone who seems to have good judgment and seems to be cool and collected, calm, sensible. See, I think in this election what has helped Obama so greatly was the his demeanor during those three debates. And somehow or other, McCain came across as being abrasive and even angry, harsh. And Obama came across as more placid and in control of himself, in command of himself, and maybe one can even say more likely to be an effective commander-in-chief than McCain, for all his experience, would make. So I think the gentleman is very much on the mark with this, and I really do try to calculate what someone's judgment will be as opposed to experience. I don't discount that experience can be useful, valuable, but I wouldn't put it above judgment.
Thanks so much for the call. And he's run such a smart campaign, yeah. Professor Dalek, that he has, and visionary in a sense, that he's got the good sense, and without being over the top, to announce he's running for president in Springfield, Illinois, of all places, yeah. at the old state capitol. Here we are in Abraham Lincoln's 200th birthday celebration.
That's right.
And the comparisons, you can't help but make them, and you think about history and how historic it is and how he's used that to his advantage. And I don't say that in a disparaging way. He knew what to do.
I couldn't agree more. He and we're going to see the same now, I think, with an Obama administration. There will be the invocation of the FDR experience, Roosevelt. It will be, in some ways, a Roosevelt New Deal moment. And very much the Lincoln moment, because you're quite right. It's going to be the 200th anniversary of Lincoln's birth this coming February, and it will be so apt to is the next Illinois resident who becomes president of the United States. But he has run a very good campaign. See, he's not only a highly intelligent man, in my judgment, but someone with exceptionally impressive political instincts.
Mm-hmm.
And Franklin Roosevelt, it was said of him, he was a man of second-class intellect but first-class temperament.
Hmm.
And one could say the same about Ronald Reagan. Reagan had political intelligence. He wasn't the brightest bulb on the block, but he had a kind of political understanding and feel for how to bring the public to his side. And it's so important in this democracy of ours to understand that. Doesn't mean you have to be slavishly following public opinion, but you certainly want to have some greater understanding of where the public's at. And this Iraq war is a good example of how this administration failed to do that. You can't, because you get some resolution through the Congress. Once you start sacrificing blood and treasure, you better be sure that the public is with you. And it takes a kind of political judgment and intelligence, I think, to sustain that kind of support. And my impression is Obama understands that. Indeed, we already see, he was asked by some journalists yesterday, I think, or the day before, why haven't you had any press conferences lately? And he said, I'll have one on Wednesday.
Wednesday, right.
And he will. Now right. He wins. That will be his first thing to do, to speak to the country, to try and generate fresh confidence, new confidence, that we can deal with this economic problem. It's going to be very interesting. There'll be a conference at the White House on November 15th. I'm sure you've seen this.
Yes.
Leading nations, that Bush's 20 nations, I think, Bush will preside at this conference. What will Obama do about this? I doubt that he will come. He's not going to want to be identified with, associated with Bush the way Roosevelt didn't want to be identified with Herbert Hoover, you see. Doesn't mean he'll boycott it. He may send a representative, but he's going to take a certain distance from Bush for the rest of the the weeks that remain of the Bush administration. And it'll be very smart politics on his part, I believe.
Mary from Racine. Hi, Mary.
Hi.
Hi.
Professor Dalek, it's an honor.
Thank you.
My question is about Bush, and I wondered if you, as a historian, think about him as being a failed president, and if so, I just wondered if you'd be willing to compare him in terms of like character and decision-making ability against past presidents like Warren G. Harding or, you know, those wusses before the Civil War like Buchanan and Franklin Pierce, and sort of how does he stack up against them?
Yeah, I think, you know, I think your point is well taken. I think he will be remembered as a bottom feeder, as someone who does not stand very high in the pantheon of presidents. I'm afraid he. I had a friend, to be candid, who was from Texas, is still from Texas, and. Very savvy about politics. In fact, he had been in the Lyndon Johnson administration. And I saw him in 2000 when Bush was running. He came to Washington, D.C., where I live, and he and I had lunch. And he said to me, Bobby said, this fellow Bush was okay as governor. He could, he did it. He was okay as governor, but he's not presidential timber. And I think his words ring true to me to this day. I just don't think George W. Bush was up to doing the job. And sad, because the country bought into this for 8 years, and I think we're paying a heavy price. Now, I don't want to go so far as to say, oh, you know, all the difficulties should be thrown on to George W. Bush. After all, it's not as if he controls everything about the economy, and they have been responsive in some sensible ways to this economic downturn. But by and large, I think he will be seen as a failed president, as someone who made bad judgments about Katrina, New Orleans, about this Iraq war, and about deregulation, which has gotten us in significant part into this economic thicket. So I'm no fan of his, and I think he's going to. He's hoping that he'll be remembered the way Harry Truman is. But what I say is, I think he's reaching for something that he's not going to achieve. And I think, in significant part, it has to do with the fact that he's never put in place a larger design the way Truman did. Truman had containment, but what is Bush's larger design to dealing with? the jihadists. I don't see what it is. I'm not saying that I have something I would suggest or that anybody has come forward to suggest something that would be the equal of containment for the next 20 or 30 or 40 years. But I don't see Bush having achieved this, and so I think he will be remembered as in the bottom rank of American presidents.
Robert Dulick, thank you so much for being with us. Have a great day tomorrow voting at your party.
Wonderful to have been with you.
Yeah, it's always a pleasure, and thanks for all of the body of knowledge you've added to our understanding of the American presidency. Robert Dulick, our guest this hour, his latest book is Truman. One of my favorites is An Unfinished Life, which I have in front of me now, John F. Kennedy, 1917 to 1963, but he's written just highly well-written and informative books on many of the American presidents. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, and to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here as well. Just a reminder that we are going to be having National Public Radio special coverage tonight of the election from 9 until 11, and then join us starting at 6 o'clock tomorrow night and going until the wee hours, perhaps, for National Public Radio coverage and Wisconsin Public Radio coverage of all the races going on here in the state. So thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, this is the Ideas Network.